You are listening to The Morning Magazine for Monday, October 4th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear from Saturday's Women's Rights March in Denver, calling for greater protections for what is still a constitutional right to access a safe and legal abortion. We'll get a preview of what's coming up on this afternoon's Metro Show, and the CityCast Denver crew examines the legal technicalities of urban marijuana delivery. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC headlines, and then it's a public affair. Today, Frank Dubofsky talks with Boulder Chamber of Commerce CEO John Taylor. They discuss the state of the Boulder economy and how local businesses are coping during the pandemic. And as always on Monday morning, it's Counterspin at 9 a.m., a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. Then at 9:30, it's The Morning Sound Alternative with Doug Gertner. All that's still ahead this morning, but first a look at local and regional headlines with KGNU's Jamie Sudler.
On Saturday, thousands of people rallied at the state capitol in Denver in support of reproductive rights and freedom. Hundreds of people also turned out in both Boulder and Longmont as part of the National Women's March, in which 600 protests took place across the country. The demonstrations occurred just a couple of days before the beginning of the term for the U.S. Supreme Court, which will hear arguments about the future of abortion rights. We'll have more on the Women's March rally after headlines. On Friday, Colorado's epidemiologist said that despite a downward trend in COVID-19 cases across the state, there's been an uptick of infections among children 6 to 11 years old. The Colorado Sun reports that kids under 12 are still the only group ineligible to get a vaccination because no shot has yet been approved. However, the drug company Pfizer is going through the final steps to gain approval for those 5 and older. Scott Bookman, the state's pandemic incident commander, said that the state is at an incredibly high rate of hospitalizations compared to where they want to be. He added that it continues to be a pandemic of the unvaccinated, and they will not feel comfortable until hospitalizations go down significantly. On Friday, nearly 830 people were in hospital in Colorado with the virus. Almost 80% of them were unvaccinated. On Friday morning, about 350 janitors, most of whom are people of color and immigrants, walked off their jobs, striking for better pay and work conditions. The workers are members of the Service Employees International Union Local 105 and work for Flagship Facility Services, or its subcontractors. Their contract expired Thursday night, and they have been involved in negotiations for weeks. The Denver Channel reports that the janitors are paid just under $16.50 per hour. While they struck on Friday, the workers agreed to go back to work on Saturday with no deal in place, but hoping one can be reached this week. Other workers at the airport are threatening to go on strike. A security officer at Denver International told KDVR that their demands for higher pay have gone unheeded, despite the fact they are usually the first responders. He said that most of them are working 16 hours a day, 5 days a week. At least two organizations are planning to object to new congressional district maps in the state. The new districts are part of a plan submitted to the Colorado Supreme Court last week. Colorado Public Radio reports that some contend the map does not represent Latinos and other minority groups adequately and dilutes their voices. One group called Claro, the Colorado Latino Leadership Advocacy and Research Organization, said in a statement that the redistricting proposal is an incredibly disappointing outcome for Latinos and voters as a whole. The organization had advocated for a district in southern Colorado, but the commission prioritized competitiveness over communities of interest. Another group, the League of United Latin American Citizens, will also file a brief with the court explaining its concerns about the southern part of the state. According to CPR, the southern region of the state under the new map would be in a safe Republican district. The Colorado Supreme Court has until November 1st to approve the proposed map or send it back to the newly formed Independent Redistricting Commission. In other news involving the Colorado Supreme Court, the FBI is investigating the circumstances involving the awarding of a contract to a former employee of the Judicial Department. The Denver Post reports that a $2.5 million contract was given to the employee after she threatened to file a tell-all sexual discrimination lawsuit. The investigation by the FBI is now one of six that have started after the Post revealed that Mindy Macias, the former chief of staff for the Judicial Department, received a five-year training contract allegedly to keep her from revealing allegations of misconduct. According to the paper, Macias would have disclosed indiscretions at the highest level of the state's court system, including allegations that justices of the Supreme Court ordered evidence to be destroyed. At the time the contract was awarded, Macias was being fired from the State Department because of financial improprieties. Police officers in Aurora have voted in a poll to disapprove of Chief Vanessa Wilson, who has been committed to reforming the embattled department and improving its reputation. The Denver Post reports that Wilson called for expedited internal affairs investigations and fired three officers who were involved in a scandal where police were photographed while imitating a chokehold used on Elijah McClain, who later died after being injected with ketamine by Aurora first responders. The Aurora officers voted 442-16, expressing their disapproval of Chief Wilson. The head of the Aurora Police Association told the Post that the vote was prompted by the chief's reopening of an investigation into a traffic stop of a black man who said he was tackled and stunned with a taser by officers. In the weather today and tomorrow, we'll have sunny skies and highs in the upper 70s with an overnight low of about 49. Right now, it's about 52 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Women's rights groups in all 50 states held rallies Saturday in support of women's reproductive freedoms. The rallies came in response to the most restrictive abortion law in the country, Texas Senate Bill 8, or as it's called by proponents, the Heartbeat Bill. KGNU's Verity Matthews reports from Denver.
The Denver March for Reproductive Rights drew around 5,000 attendees Saturday morning to push back against the steady chipping away of the right to a safe, legal abortion. Susie Schuckman is a lead organizer of Women's March Denver.
Today's demonstration is in solidarity with those impacted by the vicious and heinous restrictions being placed upon abortion access in Texas. We're already seeing impacts to our providers here in Colorado from people fleeing Texas trying to find that essential health care. There are many other cities participating today, which shows and demonstrates the need for us to continue this work, which we will continue to advocate for within our region and stand in solidarity with those across the country.
The lawn at the Colorado State Capitol filled with protesters gathered to hear from speakers, including CEO of Planned Parenthood of the Rocky Mountains, Vicki Cowart. After stepping down from the podium, Cowart told KGNU that her organization is already seeing evidence of Texan women with the means having to travel out of state for abortion services.
A lot of folks are coming, but think about the people who don't have a working car, don't have the gas money, don't have the time off from work, there's a whole complicated, imagine having to put your life on hold to go get your health care in a state that's 600 miles away. It's complicated, and not everybody can do that, and it's really hitting people hard. This is forced pregnancy for the people who can't get here. They are going to, the state is going to cause them to have a child that they didn't plan for and wasn't in their life plan.
Rallygoers shared in that frustration, including an older woman bearing a sign that said, "Against abortion, get a vasectomy."
To me, abortion is not the problem, it's a symptom. And until we address the problem, nothing's going to change. This has been going on for millennia, and will continue to do so if we don't address the problem.
So were you out and protesting before Roe was decided?
Yes. I've been out protesting since the 60s. My arm's getting tired of carrying this sign over decades.
A handful of counter-protesters were in attendance, but their voices were drowned out by supporters of reproductive rights.
You are outnumbered! You are outnumbered! You are outnumbered!
The increasingly restrictive political climate in Texas has prompted some of its residents to move to other states. Christina Taylor is a mother of two kids and is originally from Texas. She now lives in Colorado, where she was able to access an abortion at 20 weeks gestation after it became clear her pregnancy was high risk and the child she was carrying had no chance of survival outside of the womb.
I needed abortion care and I got it, and it was kind of amazing that it wasn't a thing. It wasn't a fight. And so I just want Coloradans to know how fortunate we are here, and we have a responsibility to hold the line, because so many people come from out of state. So many people come here for abortion care, and it's something that we can very easily take for granted if we're not in a position to need it, or, you know, if, especially, you know, like families who want children. You know, you never know, like me, I never thought that I would need an abortion, and I did. I wanted to have a million kids, and I have, and it's been wonderful, and abortion is part of the reason why I've been able to do that.
Participants of the Women's March Denver Reproductive Rights Rally included women and men, young and old.
My name is Barbara Forney, and just brought it out to come out to let everybody know that this is our body, and we should not be dictated on what's right with our body.
And who's joining you today?
That would be my daughter and my mother, so three generations.
The mood among those in attendance was one of positivity and camaraderie, but one theme seemed shared by all. Frustration.
What brought me out is what brought all these, I have no idea, I'm not good with numbers, but probably 1,000 people out here today, because we do value the fact that women need to be safe and always protected and always able to make their own choices and decisions.
March participant Roz Heisey said that while having to push back against encroachments on the reproductive rights of women over decades can be disheartening, she was glad to see a broader range of supporters.
I would just like to add that I am thrilled to see so many men here supporting the issue as well, so many young people, children. You know, I've been working on this issue for 50 years and cannot believe we're still having this conversation.
For KGNU, I'm Verity Matthews in Denver.
Coming up on this afternoon's Metro Show, host Miriam Schiff interviews Dr. Kate White, an obstetrician and gynecologist and miscarriage survivor, about how the medical community can better serve women who have suffered a miscarriage. Dr. White is the author of the book, Your Guide to Miscarriage and Pregnancy Loss, Hope and Healing When You're No Longer Expecting.
What was the catalyst for you to write this book now at this particular time?
So I had been taking care of people experiencing miscarriage and pregnancy loss for 20 years, but it was the experience of having two losses of my own that made me really learn all the things that doctors don't get to see their patients experience. I didn't realize that more than one person experiences that loss when I got to watch my own husband struggle with not only supporting me, but his own feelings of grief and loss. I didn't realize my patients had to then work with their own parents who are feeling the loss of a potential grandchild and can't always be there for their own kids. How you tell other children that there won't be a baby after all, and then how you go back to work after being out going through this loss and dealing with well-meaning coworkers who don't know what to say. So it was the experience of going through it myself and thinking, what resource do I even need? Even as a physician, I didn't have access to, I think, the resources I really needed. So I wrote the book that I wanted to have when I had my own loss.
That's coming up this afternoon at 3 p.m. on Metro, right here on KGNU.
The KGNU Board of Directors reminds listeners that all our board meetings are open to the public. The KGNU Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. on the second Monday of every month. We also have a community advisory board that meets twice a year. All meeting dates, times, and locations are posted in advance on our website, kgnu.org. You can also get more information on KGNU board meetings by calling 303-449-4885 during business hours, or by sending an email to board@kgnu.org.
The first legal weed deliveries recently started in Denver, but like many aspects of the marijuana business, the actual implementation of legal delivery hasn't been easy. Currently, only 6 dispensaries are permitted for delivery, and so far just one has launched. CityCast Denver host Bree Davies talks with journalist and podcast host Anne-Marie Awad about what makes the delivery process so cumbersome for local companies, and what it means for those impacted by the war on drugs, and how accessible or inaccessible cannabis delivery really is for the average Denverite.
Anne-Marie Awad, welcome back to CityCast Denver.
Good to be here. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're talking about cannabis delivery today, which has been in this kind of weird limbo for a while. Could you briefly explain where the city of Denver is with delivery licenses?
Yeah, so delivery licenses are available. And I think if you have lived in Denver for a little while, there's maybe a little bit of deja vu when it comes to like social consumption, where it's available, it's around, but can people actually obtain a license and open a viable business and make money off of it? TBD.
Yeah, it is in this weird place. Like, delivery is legal, but only one company is doing it. Like, what is it? How's it working? Or not working, I guess?
Very similar to social consumption, again, in the sense that it is a regulatory system that was created by, like, committee. And so there are all these requirements that are really difficult and honestly very expensive to meet to get one of these licenses. And so by virtue of doing things like opening up delivery, raising the dispensary limit cap, and offering social equity licenses, those are things that are very nice on paper. But in practice, they so far are not really getting people anywhere. You said it. There's one person that's got a license so far. By all accounts, they're difficult to get still.
Who is that person or this company?
Duba. It is a company started by a guy who I believe also has a cannabis conviction on his record. So he qualifies for these social equity licenses. And right now he is partnered with the dispensary Strawberry Fields, I believe.
Yes.
And that's kind of how this law works, is that a dispensary has to partner with like a third party for delivery.
Well, and that's what I'm wondering too is like, so you mentioned to get this license, you have to qualify for a social equity designation. Is that part of this delivery issue?
In City of Denver, those licenses are set aside for what's called social equity applicants. And these are applicants that are considered to be from areas that are have been impacted quite a bit by the war on drugs, or who have family members, or who themselves have criminal records related to cannabis, things like that. But I think what you've seen in other states is that this is like a really difficult category to specify. And like you can catch a lot of people in this category who don't necessarily need these benefits.
The social equity category.
Right. And then something that, you know, I reported on a lot over the last year is companies, multi-state companies can take full advantage of these programs, no problem. It does not keep them out. And so there has to be like a real question of if you are creating these licenses for people who have fewer resources, less capital, are not like socially well-connected, wealthy, stuff like that. And then you're setting them up to compete on the same exact playing field as the big Uber of weed, honestly, for lack of a better term. I think that explains a bit about why you haven't seen a lot of delivery services come online yet.
So what you're saying is there are these larger companies that do weed delivery in other places, and they're able to potentially take advantage of being a service here in Denver by applying because they may have someone on their staff that fits that social equity profile?
Yeah. Well, so the way that it ends up working is that you can't have big corporations that operate in multiple states – like you can with any other business because it's weed. So all yeah. these companies have to sort of set up operations from scratch in new states. So despite being really well established in California, where they're originally based, and in other states on the West Coast, they do have to start from scratch here. But they can poach out candidates who sort of fit this description and could qualify for the license. But whether or not that candidate is actually going to get a real slice of ownership or make any real money off of it, you know, isn't required by the law. Like it doesn't, you know, there's no way to ensure that. And so what you've seen in a lot of other states is that, you know, these large companies can pull in people who, yes, qualify for these social equity programs and then have them sign really predatory contracts or have them sign contracts where they're putting up a lot of their own money to go into this business. The one in particular arrangement that we focused on in the last season in Massachusetts, it was like anywhere money was changing hands, the larger company was getting a cut. And so it doesn't really give like a new business owner, like a mom and pop type of person, a real chance to like grow their business and own it in the long term, like in a meaningful way. And so it's like when we're talking about, yeah, social equity licenses are going to increase ownership in this industry among marginalized people or people who have been harmed by the war on drugs. It's a head scratcher as to how that's actually supposed to happen in that long term. When there isn't anything in the law that prevents large companies from getting into this, you know what I mean? Like there isn't anything that says this has to be like a small business of no more than X number of people.
Right.
You know?
So you're saying that there's social equity regulations in place, but in reality, they're not really implementable.
No, it's not. And I go back to social consumption. It's a lot of the same reasons, too. It's like we have distance requirements for facilities. And so this locks up most of the real estate, especially among like existing cannabis businesses. I think this is the other thing is like the industry in Denver is huge and it's really consolidated among a handful of companies now. And they got to compete with them, too. You're asking social equity applicants to compete with big national companies like Ease, you're asking them to compete with the big statewide companies like LiveWell, like Terrapin Station. And it's just not, it's not a fair fight. It really isn't.
Why do you think this keeps happening?
The theme of delivery in Denver and in social consumption, social equity, all of these cannabis regulations that have come out over the last several years has been, we've got plenty of time to figure this out. And I think at a certain point, you have to recognize how out of touch that makes you sound.
Yes.
Because the most vulnerable people don't have plenty of time.
Yeah.
You know, there still isn't like a easy way to get a cannabis conviction cleared off your record in this state. And, you know, every year that goes by for a person that has that on their record, that's a lease they can't sign or renew. That's a job they can't accept. That's a roof they can't keep over their head. Those are real material consequences to taking all the time you need to figure this out.
Yeah, let alone someone who wants to get into the business and has that on their record.
Let alone.
You're just talking about everyday experiences that folks with these records, the things that they encounter just in their everyday lives.
Yeah, it's like on paper, you can have a conviction and start a business. But in reality, if you are a person who's been living your life with a cannabis conviction, you probably can't get a loan. You probably don't have venture capitalist friends. You probably don't have a real estate broker.
Right.
Like, I just think there's not enough holistic thinking to actually make a real equity impact. And I know there's lobbyists in the room. I think like that's also a really fundamental piece of this conversation too, is that the cannabis industry, God, Colorado voters legalized recreational cannabis almost 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
This is not a baby industry anymore. It's not even an adolescent anymore. This is an industry that has heaps of lobbyists like any other industry.
Right.
And they're not just in the Colorado State House every year. They are in Congress, believe it or not. And they have so much sway over policy. And honestly, at this point in time in Colorado, with the way that the business has become consolidated and very exclusive, the only way to advance social equity is for that business to sacrifice something materially. And until that happens, it's not going to move the needle.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm. or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that does it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Jamie Sudler, Verity Matthews, and Miriam Schiff for their contributions to today's program, and to Dr. Decibel for production support.